This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
For an insider's view of your favorite college and professional sports teams, there is no better source than Sports Illustrated. Award-winning reporting along with exclusive interviews. Always be up to date with Spotlight on Sports, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Spotlight on Sports, and I'm your reader, Delana, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from Sports Illustrated and USA Today Sports Weekly. Now, let's begin with an article from USA Today Sports Weekly, copyright 2025 USA Today Sports Weekly. This is by Bob Nightingale, the 10 biggest MLB hot stove questions. Free agents, trade rumors to watch. They gather last week at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas Hotel, playing cards, throwing dice, talking shop, and trying to con their buddies. It's the annual Major League Baseball General Manager meetings where they will stage the ultimate game. They have you believe in their ownership has no money, only to fork over $400 million for free agent outfielder Kyle Tucker or assigned starters Framber Valdez and Dylan Cease. They'll convince you that Munetaka Mukurakami is nothing more than an overhyped strikeout machine out of Japan, but quietly slip in as one of the top bidders for the power-hitting infielder. They'll publicly deny the Cy Young winner Tarek Skubal and other stars on the trade market, only to tell 29 other GMs to make their best offer, but to keep it quiet. They'll bemoan trying to compete with the Los Angeles Dodgers, only to boldly tell their ownership that one shrewd move will make them the team to finally topple the two-time defending World Series champions. MLB has privately told owners that teams lost $1.8 billion last year, led by the New York Mets with about $350 million in losses. But, of course, that's paper money. It doesn't reveal the financial growth in franchise value, record revenues, or that their owner is worth $21 billion. Whether the losses will have any effect or simply be shrugged off, it will be a constant theme heard from the dealers to the slots to the sports bookies. Here are the top 10 questions heading into the GM meetings, and by the time things conclude later this week, maybe then will we at least have some hints to answers. Number one question, will teams spend like usual or stash away a lockout fund? No one knows for sure. But there wasn't a single GM interviewed by USA Today Sports who was told by their ownership that they will spend less because of a potential lockout. Number two question, which teams are expected to be the most aggressive in free agency? Well, Los Angeles Dodgers just freed up $87 million with Clayton Kershaw, Michael Conforto, Chris Taylor, and Kirby Yates off the books. They'll still be aggressive as anyone and will come away at the least with a high-priced closer. Looking at the New York Mets, they embarrassed themselves by having the biggest payroll and failed to make the playoffs. And owner Steve Cohen hates to be embarrassed. They'll come up with one, if not two, frontline starters. Looking at the Baltimore Orioles, they can't afford to miss the postseason again, or GM Mike Elias' job is on the line. They have to bring in a frontline starter. For the New York Yankees, they must spend just to keep up with the rest of the powerful AL East and will either bring back Cody Bellinger or sign Kyle Tucker. Atlanta President Terry McGuirk recently told shareholders they plan to be a top five payroll team, which means adding $50 million to their player budget. Toronto Blue Jays, they just earned an extra $50 million or so in revenue from their World Series run. They'll put it right back into the team, and they could be the favorite for Tucker. The number three question, which team could be the hot stove's biggest sleeper? The Chicago Cubs know that finishing second to the Milwaukee Brewers in the NL Central every year is inexcusable, and with Tucker expected to depart for greater riches, they'll have plenty of money to burn. They want another corner outfielder and will be shopping in the expensive aisle for starter pitchers, with fellow GMs predicting they could land Valdez or Dylan Cease. Kyle Tucker, Bo Bichet, and Alex Bregman land? Tucker, a native of Tampa, will sign with the Yankees, Toronto Blue Jays, Los Angeles Dodgers, GMs predict. The San Francisco Giants are a dark horse, but considering they still owe Rafael Devers $250 million, are in the second year of a seven-year $182 million contract with Willie Adames, and the second of a six-year $151 million extension with Matt Chapman, there's only so many nine-figure contracts the Giants can seemingly afford. They are paying $137 million alone to their top six players next year: Devers, Chapman, Adames, Robbie Ray, Logan Webb, and Jung-Hoo Lee. And don't forget, they're paying a record $10.5 million in salaries for a manager in 2026. $4 million to fired Bob Melvin, $3.5 million to new manager Tony Vitello, and $3 million to Tennessee for Vitello's buyout. Don't be surprised if the Blue Jays are the perfect fit. Bichet, who was expected to depart Toronto a year ago, whose name surfaced a year ago in trade talks, now is expected to stay put to complete their goodwill tour. Bregman won't get $40 million a year from the Red Sox after walking away from $80 million over 2 years, but the Red Sox still make the most sense, particularly with the Tigers proving they can win without him, and the Cubs finding a third baseman with rookie Matt Shaw. Question number five. Does Pete Alonso finally find a permanent home with the Mets? Nope. David Stearns, Mets president of baseball operations, was ready to let Alonso walk last year. Alonso had a monster year, but still, they missed the playoffs, making it easier to walk away now. They are preaching defense, in the words of Stearns, run prevention, and are expected to let him depart unless he signs a deal they can't turn down. GMs are predicting the perfect landing spot for Alonso must be maybe with the Red Sox. Will number six, will Tarik Skubal or Paul Skeens get traded? No and no. The Pirates won't even listen to trade proposals for Skeens, so don't bother calling. And the Tigers will at least listen on Skubal, but would have to be completely overwhelmed, considering that teams know that he won't sign an extension and plans to hit free agency in a year, commanding the biggest deal or a pitcher in history. And no one will dare up give more than two top 10 prospects. The Tigers are expected to hang on to him until at least the July 2026 trade deadline. Number seven question, will the Phillies keep DH Kyle Schwarber? He's the heartbeat of their team and means everything to their clubhouse, let alone his impact on the field with 187 homers the past 4 years. Still, tough decisions loom. The Phillies lost about $85 million last year, even after drawing 3.35 million fans, thanks to a $56 million luxury tax hit. They'll make some changes this winter, but desperately need Schwarber. Is Munetaka Murakami the real deal? The jury is out, and no one has a strong sense of just what he'll bring in the major leagues. The power is real, with 5 seasons for at least 3 homers and 246 homers in 892 games. But so is the strikeout rate, which was an alarming 29% last year in Japan, Most troubling, his contact rate was just 63 against pitchers' 93 miles per hour of fastball since 2022, according to Fangraphs. The average fastball in MLB last season was 94.5 miles per hour. Scouts also believe he's more ideal as a third baseman than a first baseman. If teams don't want to take the gamble on Murakami, they'll turn to a 29-year-old corner infielder. He doesn't have the power of Murakami, but he's a better contact hitter, with scouts believing he'll have an easier transition to big league pitching. So, on to question number 9. Who's on the MLB trade block? Minnesota Twins starter Joe Ryan and Pablo Lopez. The Twins have two of the greatest trade chips and could completely rebuild their organization by trading away these pitchers. Lopez, still under control for 2 more years at $21.5 million a season, while Ryan still has 2 years of club control and is salary arbitration eligible after earning $3 million last year. Cincinnati Reds ace Hunter Green. Despite their recent public denials, they still plan to listen to offers for Green. Yet, unless they're completely overwhelmed and receive a return that will help them not only now but in the future, they'll keep him. He's owed still only $39 million over the next 3 years, with a $21 million club option in 2029. The Reds aren't going to find a better pitcher at a better discount price. Arizona Diamondbacks all-star second baseman Ketel Marte. The Diamondbacks will ask for a lot in return, but they are definitely motivated in moving him, with $71 million remaining through 2030. If they don't move him by mid-April, he will have a 10-5 rights and a full no-trade provision. Miami Marlins ace Sandy Alcantara. The Marlins never got the offer they wanted to move their former Cy Young winner, but this winter are set to accept the best offer they receive, believing now is the time. He earns $17.3 million in 2026 with a $21 million club option in 2027. San Diego Padres all-star right fielder Fernando Tatis Jr. They certainly don't want to trade him and still may not listen now. But with all of their bloated and backloaded contracts, someone is going to eventually have to depart. And no one making big money has more trade value than Tatis, whose 14-year, $340 million contract suddenly looks rather seasonable. Next, we have St. Louis Cardinals starter Sonny Gray. Gray is one of the finest starters on the trade block, but he's also earning $35 million this year and has a full no-trade clause. He has a $30 million club option in 2027. The Cardinals will have to eat some of the contract if they want to move him. Houston Astros first baseman Christian Walker. Walker's name came up in trade talks with Minnesota Twins when they landed Carlos Correa, and they'll gladly listen to all the offers for him this winter, trying to shed the remaining 2 years and $40 million in his contract. Cardinals third base Nolan Arenado. He rejected deals to the Houston Astros and Los Angeles Angels a year ago. This time around, he may not say no to anybody and will be willing to waive his no-trade clause to get out of town. The Cardinals will have to pay down some of the remaining $31 million left on his contract through 2027. Milwaukee Brewers starter Freddy Peralta. Despite the rumors and speculation, the Brewers are planning to keep him. Knowing that at $8 million, he's an absolute steal, making 33 starts and striking out 200 batters, and they need him if they're going to run it back again. Washington Nationals starter Mackenzie Gore. The Nationals have a whole new front office, new coaching staff, and new ideas. They are expected to use Gore, who has 2 more years of club control, as the trade bait to kickstart their new era. Cleveland Guardians outfielder Stephen Kwan. They nearly traded him to the Dodgers at the trade deadline, and Los Angeles will come calling again. The price tag will be high, but the Dodgers certainly have the prospect capital. Boston Red Sox outfielder Jaron Duran. The Red Sox believe they need an upgrade over Duran, that he needs a fresh start. It would be a huge surprise if he's in Fort Myers, Florida come spring training. Miami Marlins starter Edward Cabrera. He still has 3 more years of control and is coming off his best season. but he has never had more trade value than now after never pitching 100 innings before last season. Pittsburgh Pirates starter Mitch Keller. You can't have Paul Skeens, but Mitch Keller, who was in trade talks last summer with the Chicago Cubs, is more than available. He still has 3 more years left on his deal, and it pays him $15.9 million in 26, $18.4 million in 27, $20.4 million in 2028, and the Pirates love nothing more than saving money. Athletics starter Luis Severino. Severino, who signed a 3-year, $67 million contract last winter with the Athletics, has made it clear that he doesn't like pitching in Sacramento. The A's have made it clear that they don't like him constantly complaining about it. Both sides are willing to move on. Yankees prospect Spencer Jones. After floating his name in trade talks for the past year, the Yankees could finally move one of their top prospects. And the question number 10, will trades go down at the GM meetings? Yes, well, there likely won't be a single trade consummated, but the best trade was engineered 3 months ago by the Toronto Blue Jays. They took the gamble of trading for pitching prospect Carl Stephan for Shane Bieber, who was still recovering from Tommy John surgery. Bieber produced just as they'd hoped, leading them to Game 7 of the World Series by yielding a 3.57 ERA in 7 regular season starts and a 3.87 ERA in 5 playoff appearances. Then Bieber decided to exercise his opt-in and stay next season for $16 million. Considering he had a $4 million buyout, he actually staying for $12 million, the price of an 8th inning reliever these days. The Blue Jays, a team where free agents once used leverage but avoid suddenly, has become the ultimate destination spot for free agents. Sticking with USA Today Sports Weekly, the section of remembrance, Dallas DE's death, what we know. This article discusses suicide and suicidal ideation. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, help is available. Call or text 988 or chat at 988lifeline.org. The NFL world was rocked on the morning of November 6th when the Dallas Cowboys announced the death of defensive end Marshawn Nyland. Later in the day, the Frisco, Texas Police Department provided further details regarding Nyland's passing. A second-round draft pick out of Western Michigan University last year, Nyland, 24, had started 3 games in his second professional season and found himself temporarily in the spotlight of the Cowboys' November 3rd loss to the Arizona Cardinals at AT&T Stadium. Frisco, Nyland's cause of death. Frisco police have characterized his death as a possible suicide suffered. He apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound and had expressed suicidal ideations. The Frisco police have involved with what they turned out to be his final hours. At 10:39, Frisco police joined the Texas Department of Public Safety in the hunt for the vehicle, apparently driven by him, after he had evaded authorities followed its entry into the city. Authorities found the vehicle, which had crashed but had been abandoned, and Nyland apparently leaving the scene on foot, according to the police. K-9 units and drones were dispatched to search for him. And at 1:31 a.m. on November 6th, Nyland's body was found with what was believed to be a lethal self-inflicted gunshot wound. My heart goes out to his family, in quotes, then I instantly go into what could I have done better mode. Greg Ellis, a former NFL defensive who coached Nyland's last year but is no longer on the Cowboys coaching staff, told USA Today Sports' Jarrett Bell. In hindsight, obviously, I wish I would have followed my instinct and sent more messages to let him know that I'm here for anything he would need to talk about. So you just look back and you think he was a bright, smiley guy, but he was also a guy that had a deep sadness look about him through a lot of things. I felt that in him, I saw that in him, and I just wasn't around him enough to help him deal with that. The Cowboys were on a bye week for week 10. Their next game was played on November 17th. Players typically don't speak to reporters during a bye week. And then in remembrance, we have former NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue dies at 84. This is written by Michael Middlehurst Schwartz. Former NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue, who guided the league to new heights of financial prosperity during his 17-year run, yet drew heavy scrutiny for his handling of the league's concussion crisis, died Sunday, November 9th, in Chevy Chase, Maryland. His family announced he was 84. Tagliabue's apparent cause of death was heart failure complicated by Parkinson's disease, which he was diagnosed with approximately 7 years ago. Tagliabue, who was previously an attorney for the league, served as NFL commissioner from 1989 to 2006, taking over for Pete Rozelle. During that span, he helped the league navigate several crises, including the decision to postpone games at the 9/11 terrorist attacks and handling the fallout from Hurricane Katrina. His ability to broker labor peace and avoid any work stoppages has been widely credited as a major factor in the league's financial boom during his tenure. With billions pouring in from multiple new media rights deals over the course of his time at the helm, franchise values boomed. Tagliabue's time during a good deal of movement for teams with two new organizations, the Carolina Panthers and Jacksonville Jaguars in 1995, starting up in that stretch, while two other cities got teams back with the rebooted Cleveland Browns 1999 and Houston Texans in 2002. 20 new stadiums were constructed while he served as commissioner, which marked the start of a facilities arms war and helped further boost team values. Under his watch, the league also instituted free agency and a salary cap. Yet several of Tagliabue's remarks and decisions regarding concussions and head injuries clouded his time. In 2017, he apologized for his 1994 comment that is relatively small, the problem is the journalist issue. End quote. They were some things that we did which probably should have been done much quicker, Tagliabue told USA Today sports Jarrett Bell in 21. But in the longer run, what's happened in the last 20 years suggests it might not have made that much difference. Put it another way, for the most part, I think we did things at the time that could have made the most difference, end quote. After retiring, Tagliabue was succeeded by current NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Tagliabue was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2020 as part of the centennial class. Switching to Sports Illustrated, this is the December 2025 edition, Volume 136, Number 11, Copyright 2025 Sports Illustrated, ABGSI LLC. Starting with Scorecard, this is an essay, No Longer on Thin Ice, written by Kristen Nelson. Several women's hockey leagues have launched and failed, but the PWHL looks poised to thrive. When Kelly Panik got a call in September 2023 to join PWHL Minnesota, everything was finally falling into place. That stands for the Professional Women's Hockey League, and the launch of it had been announced just a few days earlier, and the first puck was set to drop in 4 months. There were six franchises: Minnesota, Boston, Montreal, New York, Ottawa, and Toronto, but no team nicknames. No other players had signed on yet. Minnesota's didn't even have a coach, but Panik did not hesitate to become the first player to officially ink a contract with the league, and that is what she and hundreds of other women's hockey players had been working toward for years. It felt like a no-brainer, Panik says. Minnesota's been a huge part of my life. It's where I'm from, and it's where I've grown up. Then to continue my professional career in Minnesota, that's something I never was able to dream of. When Panik graduated from the University of Minnesota in 2019, becoming a pro wasn't a given. At that time, the Canadian Women's Hockey League CWHL had just folded. There was the National Women's Hockey League, the NWHL, but more than 200 players were boycotting it because they weren't earning livable wages. Instead, players created the Professional Women's Hockey Players Association, PWHPA, which played exhibition games to garner support for establishing a united and sustainable North American league. After 4 years of sacrificing their pro careers, there was finally a league that checked all the boxes for Panic and her peers thanks to a hefty financial commitment from Dodgers owner Mark Walter, the counsel of Billie Jean King, and an 8-year collective bargaining agreement the players worked on. It wasn't easy to get the league off the ground in a matter of months, but now heading into its third season, with team names given to those original six franchises, sellout crowds showing up across U.S. and Canada, and expansion teams set to join in Seattle and Vancouver, the PWHL has swiftly established that there is an appetite for professional women's hockey. "We tend to do things quickly around here," says Jana Hefford, the PWHL's executive vice president of hockey operations. "But what is being accomplished at a rapid pace is something many had spent years or even decades preparing for." Hefford was one of the lucky ones. During her playing days in the mid-1990s and 2000s, she didn't have to have a day job. She coached at camps, did some speaking events, and had a few endorsements. She was one of the few true professionals in the sport. "The majority of my teammates were teachers or lawyers or whatever else during the day," Hefford says. "The first league to actually pay its players' salaries was the second iteration of the NWHL. When it was founded in 2015, players were paid between $10,000 to $26,000 a season, but that didn't last long, with players' wages getting cut up to 50% in this league's second year. After the CWHL shuttered, the NWHL was the only pro option left on the continent. The game's top players decided there was too much bad blood to continue, with mistrust around everything from laughable salaries to having to pay for their own travel to facilities that didn't have adequate facilities, and players didn't have access to a locker room or bathroom during practice and thus have to relieve themselves in trash cans. You're playing in a glorified beer league," U.S. Olympian Hillary Knight said in 2020. Hefford, who was interim commissioner of the CWHL in its final season, was asked to join the PWHPA as an operations consultant. "Players initially hoped their boycott of the NWHL would last just a year, but it wasn't until the WHPA joined forces with Walter and King in 22 and officially unionized in 23 that they were finally able to make meaningful progress. We committed all along that this was going to be a player-first league," Hefford says. "That's collaboration between players and unions in the league is unlike any other league." And a 62-page CBA was signed in July 2023, setting minimum salaries at $35,000, requiring teams to pay at least six players $80,000 for the first season. And then things moved quickly. The league was officially announced that the August, with players signing contracts in September, training camp started in November, and the first puck dropped on New Year's Day in 2024. On day one, there were 2,537 fans watching at a sold-out Matami Athletic Center for Toronto versus New York, with 2.9 million viewers watched on TV in Canada alone. On day two, Ottawa set a pro women's hockey attendance record of 8,318 at TD Place. On day six, Minnesota set a new one at 13,316 at Xcel Energy Center. They took things on the road with neutral site games in Pittsburgh and Detroit, where another attendance record was set. Year two was much the same, as teams like Montreal and Toronto moved to larger venues, and the league had nine neutral site games to reach new fans. This past offseason, Emily Clark signed a record-setting contract with the Ottawa Charge, joining eight other players to reportedly make six figures. Finally, PWHL Executive Vice President of Business Operations Amy Shear told the Associated Press earlier this year that the league sponsorship has grown by 50% and merchandise sales has doubled. This wasn't just a novelty, and it certainly didn't hurt that the league hit the ice smack dab in the middle of a women's sports movement, with more eyes on the WNBA and the NWSL than ever. I think you have to pay attention to it, Panic says. I think it's really exciting to add it with the PWHL, right? What's really cool is that those leagues are 10, 20 years ahead of us, and we're still keeping pace with some of the norms in the workplace and professionalism in women's sports. To be able to kind of see the parallels and see the differences and also see where okay, that's where they got in 10 or 20 years, where we can get in 10 or 20 years. Already in the first phase of expansion, the PWHL is cruising past its own expectations. Seattle and Vancouver, both of which will carry the tradition of not having team names in their first seasons, are adding a new time zone to the league. There is talk of adding more franchises in the future, though Hefford says the league first wants to see how the new additions fare in the first half of the season. It's not lost on Hefford how different this is from not just her playing days, when it was mostly friends and family in the stands and practices were held up around 9 p.m. after work, but also from her initial days as an executive. When I was with the CWHL, we had five people working for the league. That was an international league that had teams in Canada, U.S., China at the time. Hefford says, you look at where we are now and it's amazing. You really understand the importance of the investment that needs to be made to get this off the ground. The players have a CBA. They have some certainty. They understand what they will get in return. They understand what they need to provide. As a league, just a growth of having a marketing department, having an officiating department, having groups of people that every day focus on growing the league, it's just a really exciting time. We know there's so much more growth ahead, and we're going to look different in a couple of years than we look right now. Not every team has been an instant success, though. Playing in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Elmont, New York, and Newark, the New York franchise has twice finished at the bottom of the attendance standings. New York was always going to be a tough sports market to break into, Hefford admits. There were 13 major pro teams in the metropolitan area before the Sirens came to town. Building a successful new franchise takes time, with grassroots effort at local kids' camps and finding other ways to reach fans who don't automatically gravitate toward hockey like they do in Canadian markets. New York has obviously struggled, but I see that as more of an opportunity rather than a setback, says Casey O'Brien, who was drafted third out of Wisconsin by the Sirens in June. She grew up in New York City and remembers going to Liberty games at Madison Square Garden when the team averaged 10,000 fans. The center is hoping her new team can find a way to reach that level. We can definitely follow in their footsteps. As the league grows, Hefford says, there's still a focus on making sure original franchises like the Sirens improve their vitality. Our job is to maintain the competitive balance, Hefford says. I think it's one of our greatest strengths. To keep on-the-ice product entertaining, the PWHL has deviated from what women's hockey has looked like in the past. The league always has a hybrid body check, which is more physical than what fans might be used to seeing at the collegiate level. It also has implemented the jailbreak rule, which allows a player to be freed from the penalty box when their team scores shorthanded. As the league grows, expansion has added 46 roster spots and 30 more games. Hefford says it's going to be hard to predict what happens in year three. But Panic, whose Minnesota Frost won the first two PWHL titles, has big expectations for this season, which begins on November 21st. So what can fans look for? More chaos, Panic says. I feel like our league has just some chaotic moments in game, which is so fun. I also feel like there'll be some rivalries maybe this year that start to develop with more teams. Chaos, after all, is how the PWHL started, and it seems to be working so far. Continuing with an article from Sports Illustrated, Scorecard Game Plan. Global Golf, a fledgling seniors competition, could capitalize on fans' Ryder Cup hangovers, by Jeff Ritter. Golf fans still buzzing about, or perhaps sobering up from, the recent Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black can take heart. There's yet another innovative international match play golf competition on tap before the year ends, the World Champions Cup. The second iteration of the event, which will be held from December 4th through the 7th in Clearwater, Florida, and it's going to air on ESPN and ABC, will feature players from golf's 50 and over set. The field includes several Hall of Famers, including and major winners, Justin Leonard, who helped usher in the era of the overly boisterous celebration when he clinched the 1999 Ryder Cup for the U.S. with a 45-foot putt that led to bedlam on the green and in the stands. Unlike the Ryder's Cup set up with the U.S. and Europe going head-to-head, the World Champions Cup features three teams, U.S., Europe, and the rest of the world, playing simultaneously. Each team's captain will tee up and earn points alongside their squads. Here's how it works. 2 days of team sessions will include a little-used but delightfully named format called Scottish Sixems, where players will compete in two-man teams, with each golfer teeing off, then selecting one ball to play as alternate shots for the rest of the hole. There will also be session of six ball, in which each member of a two-man team plays his own ball from start to finish. The final day features a series of traditional single matches played in threesomes. It gives us a chance to be a team again, says U.S. Captain Jim Furyk, and for snowbirds, it's a chance to show those New York fans how it's done. Sticking with Sports Illustrated, December 2025, in the scorecard section, this is History, The Golden Touch, by L. John Wertheim. In a different era, the Warriors had an owner of a very different stripe. Perched regally in the Mission Bay district of San Francisco, the Chase Center is, yes, the home of the NBA Warriors and the NWA Valkyries, but it doubles as a monument to today's sports industrial complex. Part of a waterfront development district, the arena sits nestled among Uber headquarters coffee shops that sell cappuccinos by the tankard and Oracle Park 2000, home of the San Francisco Giants, which by comparison seems downright old-timey. Sponsored by one of the world's largest banks and opened in 2019, Chase Center is a basketball pleasure dome, featuring 2 million per season bunker suites, replete with wine cellars. For the common fans, there's local fare like Bake Sale Betty's fried chicken sandwiches and pork al pastor tacos from Backyard Burritos for sale on the concourse. Parking is sparse, but there is a bicycle valet, this being San Francisco and all. Stand on the plaza and you'll enjoy a view of the Northern California terrain. Look eastward, and almost an act of trolling, you'll see Oakland, the team's previous home. The building is nicknamed the house that Steph built, but its main attraction, Steph Curry, is less a sports star than a global celebrity. He has also reported a nine-figure net worth boosted by his $60 million annual playing salary. Golden State has won 4 NBA titles in the last decade, though only one has come during the team's sixth season at the Chase Center. This is a franchise that last sold for $450 million. That was in 2010, and it is now valued around $9 billion. No one would have loved this transformation more than the Warriors' first Bay Area owner, Franklin Muley. So many of his ideas and ideals, considered fanciful at the time, have come to fruition. A team not merely representing a city, but standing as a civic treasure, creating jobs, leaking revenue like beads of sweat. Broadcast technology that enables the Warriors to attract fans well beyond the Golden State, never mind the Bay Area, an authoritative but compassionate coach, all of a time when sports have grown into their own financial sector, no longer a diversion so trivial that its section of the San Francisco Chronicle needs its own unserious color. Muley would take in the entire tableau and not merely smile approvingly, but then also laugh his familiar laugh. But all that's largely speculative because it presupposes Muley could actually be found. Here was an owner who now seems as much a relic as a 6'8 center of the NBA players working in sporting goods stores in the off-season to supplement their income. Today, slick credentialed hedge fund titans, or venture capitalists to wit, the Warriors' Joe Lake of owned teams, and now need help from private equity to make the purchase. In the 1960s, 70s, up through the mid-80s, the Warriors were owned by a man who was the son of a San Jose gardener, often slept on a houseboat, and cared as much about good vibes as balance sheets running the team, not as a CFO, but as a FAN fan. In as much as a measure of celebrity came with owning the local sports team, none of it went to Muley's head. Perhaps that's because that head was usually shrouded in a Sherlock Holmes-esque deerstalker cap. His headwear invariably set off his substantial beard and the Hawaiian shirt he favored, unbuttoned to the point that a carpet of chest hair poked out. His favorite mode of transportation, a motorcycle, though he often forgot where he'd parked it, leaving him to return to restaurant days later to retrieve his ride. As he once put it to the Chronicle, "I had too many motorcycles and too short a memory." Muley had great presence, but also great absence, a man known for his sporadic disappearances. When the urge struck or his stress levels rose, he would hide out at home or bike to Mexico or hike Yosemite. For days, even calls from his loyal assistants would go unanswered. When Sports Illustrated writer Frank DeFord was once asked Muley where he would go during his walkabouts, the owner was coy. "I'm very judicious about my hiding. I'll hide somewhere where I also have some business to take care of. I'm not going all the way to Chicago just to hide." But then, when pressed, he gave a specific example of a choice hiding spot. "Well, all right, I'll tell you. One place, because I haven't gone there recently, this place I used to go a lot was down in Santa Cruz. I'd visit some Italian fishermen up there, the Carniglia boys, and work with them. I'd put out the outfits, rubber boots, and all of it. It was very unlikely that anyone would think of looking for Franklin working with the Carniglia boys." Leave it to Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis, he of the black leather jacket, slick hair, enemies list of traffic and grievances, and offer the "just win, baby" vocabulary of war. Leave it to the Oaklanders, Charlie Finley, to berate his employees, throw round nickels if they were manhole covers, and threaten to move the team. Their fellow Bay Area sports owners would be seeking refuge with the Carniglia boys, rubber boots and all. Was Muley known to wear a fake mustache and sideburns for kicks? Was he on first-name basis with every staff of the Italian restaurant in North Beach? Did Muley more generally cut a wildly idiosyncratic profile? Yes, and yes, he did. Even his current Wikipedia page bio describes him thusly. An eccentric personality, Muley eschewed formal attire and conservative grooming in favor of a casual wardrobe and ever-present full beard and deerstalker. But that undersells his influence. Muley may have gone and been one of the more offbeat owners in pro sports, which of course is saying something, but burnished by time, he also takes his rightful place as one of the most important. By his own admission, Muley was kissed by the sports god. He stopped growing well south of 6 foot. He often battled his weight. He struggled to throw a tight spiral, but his timing was exquisite. Muley was born in San Jose in 1920, the son of Italian immigrants. His father, Giacomi, eventually ran a sprawling nursery. As a kid, Muley would make the 50-mile jaunt north from South Bay to San Francisco. There awaited a wonderland of bridges, fog, and tall buildings that seemed to literally scrape the sky and so exotic. Muley called it the city, a shorthand he would later use to market his team. After attending the University of Oregon and serving in the Navy during World War II, he got a job working in the ad department for San Francisco's Burgermeister Brewery. There, he helped arrange the marriage between beer and sports. Of course it was luck, he told SI. Everyone credited me for my clairvoyance. At first, I didn't know anything. Luck is hardly a strong enough term for what came next. Muley happened upon a newspaper item about the San Francisco 49ers possibly being up for sale. As it turned out, the account was erroneous, but Muley followed up and landed a meeting with the team's owner, Tony Morabito. They discussed Burgermeister sponsoring 49ers games on the fast-growing new medium of television. Muley seized on the idea to produce the games himself starting in 1954. He left the brewery, started a production company, gotten good with the team, and a few years later, the 49ers offered him 10% of the share in the franchise for $60,000. In 1962, Muley led an investor group that rustled up $850,000 to move the Philadelphia Warriors to San Francisco. Using his equity in the 49ers as collateral, he then obtained a controlling interest in the team a year later. After the baseball giants left New York and headed to San Francisco in 58, Muley began producing their games. He'd travel with the team, go drinking with the managers, coaches, and broadcasters, hold down the piano bar, then suddenly disappear. Chub Feeney, a Giants executive who would later become National League president, named Muley the Phantom. Muley shrugged. "It's too much trouble," he once said, "to say goodnight." After one of the Giants' owners, Joan Payson, opposed the team's relocation, Muley was happy to buy her shares and invest in baseball as well. Oh, and at the 1960 Winter Olympics in Squaw Valley, Muley produced the English language radio broadcast. As DeVore put it, suddenly this wacky florist from San Jose was the only guy in San Francisco who owned part of every team in town, and also a virtual monopoly on the sports TV and radio production that came out of the Bay Area. Still, the Warriors were his true love, though Wilt Chamberlain and the preeminent basketball player on the planet was on the team. The Warriors struggled to draw fans and hemorrhage money. Muley doubled and tripled and quadrupled down routinely, buying out fellow investors who couldn't stomach the losses. Muley was a firm believer in the gospel of the days, in the gospel of hoops. He could frequently be seen taking shots at a basket he installed outside the Warriors' modest offices. He believed that basketball translated beautifully to television. He also understood the power, both financial and communal, of the sports venue, though he had a hard time finding a decent home for his franchise in San Francisco. In the 60s, the Warriors toggled between the Dowdy Civic Auditorium and the Cal Palace, a glorified barn in Daly City, more cow than palace, whereas the name implies the stench of livestock hung thick in the air. For five seasons, the Warriors wore jerseys embroidered with the words, "The City," a nod to Muley's boy home awe of San Francisco. But without a proper venue, the Warriors filled dates in such as Bakersfield, Fresno, Las Vegas, Oakland, Richmond, Sacramento, San Diego, and San Jose. In January of 1965, Muley traded Wilt back to Philadelphia's new team, the 76ers, reasoning that San Francisco was an underdog town and a Leviathan like Chamberlain didn't fit the culture. Instead, he drafted slick-shooting Rick Barry. During the 66-67 season, the Warriors lost money but won games, advancing to the NBA Finals before losing to Chamberlain and the Sixers. Then they lost Barry, who intentionally sat out the next season to exhaust his contract and then jumped to the ABA's Oakland Oaks. The more Muley was advised to sell the team and let it leave town, more committed he became to make pro basketball work in the Bay Area. Murray Olderman of the San Francisco Examiner once wrote, "It would be easy to toss off Franklin because of his dress and casual lifestyle as a buffoon. He is a smart guy who hung on in professional basketball because he's convinced that it, like everything else that touched his life, was ultimately making him a bundle. But Muley had social as well as financial goals." In the days when the NBA was finally considered too black, he encouraged the front office to sign black players. 10 of the 12 players on the Golden State's 1975 title team were black. So was the coach, Al Attles, a former Warriors player who was one of the first black full-time coaches in professional basketball. All of his ideas were winners. Warrior employees even kept a file called Franklin's Follies, foretelling the era of luxury suites. He attempted to give the Warriors' more posh fans a premium experience by converting the first three rows of the Oakland Coliseum into tables adorned with china and tablecloths. Players were not fans. He once rode his Honda motorcycle onto the polished floor of the arena and wiped out, ironically giving the three-pointers role in the Warriors' future success. Muley was adamantly opposed to the shot, filibustering at league meetings about how it was an irredeemable gimmick. "I'm not going to deny I made a lot of mistakes, but maybe someday I'll pick up a newspaper and see what a genius I am." Meanwhile, he continued his habit of mysterious disappearances. Pete Rozelle, the former NFL commissioner, was friends with Muley. At least he thought he was. Rozelle told SA, "He's always been a floater. I see Franklin somewhere in L.A. and we'd go out to dinner and he ended up staying the night and then he'd be gone. He'd leave his socks and I'd get them laundered and mail them back to him in an envelope. He still floats. You know, you're in a group with him and all of a sudden, he disappears." By the late 70s, the Warriors were the were a sub negative .500 team, and worse, were again struggling to draw fans. Muley was reluctant to raise ticket prices for fear of reducing demand. He stuck with Attles until after the 82-83 season because, well, he liked the guy. He would become seduced by players like Joe Barry Carroll, drafting them despite others' misgiving. And Al Davis once told Muley, "The trouble with you is you got a love club over there. Everybody loves everybody." Finally, in the spring of 86, Muley had had enough. The team was losing games and money in equal measure. Coliseum wasn't the answer to the franchise's venue challenges. So Muley announced his exit plan that May. Former Milwaukee Bucks owner Jim Fitzgerald and his business partner Dan Finane purchased a controlling interest in the Warriors for around $14 million, far less than $32.5 million that the Miami Heat and Charlotte Hornets would pay as an expansion fee the following season. With that, Muley's 24-year tenure as a NBA owner was over. After the sale, he would still attend the Warriors games, no hard feelings. When Muley went MIA, sometimes his seat would be filled by a hat placed there by a fan. He would also show up for 49ers games. And his TV and radio production company lived on. Fitzgerald and Finane owned the team for 8 seasons before selling to Chris Cohen for $140 million in 94. Cohen owned the team for 15 largely hapless seasons before selling to a consortium led by Lacup and Peter Guber. By then, the Warriors still confined to the Oakland Coliseum fetched $450 million in the 15 years since. It has increased 20-fold. Franklin Muley died in 2010 at age 89, 5 years before the Warriors won their first NBA title in 40 seasons and 9 years before this franchise's sleek San Francisco home, the Chase Center, would be christened. As the W's have become one of the world's preeminent sports properties, fans of a certain age know that a great debt of gratitude is owed to 5-foot, 9-inch man with an iffy jumper who never did shake his propensity for deerstalkers and impetuousness. In the first line of a tribute, Bruce Jenkins, a dean of Bay Area sports, wrote, "In 2018, Franklin Muley was delightful company and a noted eccentric unfamiliar with formal attire and known to occasionally appear in disguise. By then, though, Muley's sports foresight and climate he helped create was there, plain as a cloudless San Francisco day out in the open for all to see and enjoy." Well, that's all the time we have today. This has been Delana with Spotlight on Sports. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.